From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Grand Rapids Public Schools are back in the classroom. How's it going?
To be able to hear the laughter on the playgrounds and kids talking to one another, you don't know you miss it until you haven't had it.
Also, a lesson in the history of sea shanties on the Great Lakes as sung by Black fishermen.
A lot of the first Black Michiganders actually came to settle in Michigan after working on these ships.
And we speak with writer Rochelle Riley about her new book featuring children dressed up as iconic and influential Black Americans.
I wanted people to know that we need to celebrate them as more than posters during Black History Month. They are a part of American history, and everybody should know them.
Stay with us. All those stories and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, writer Rochelle Riley. A couple of years ago, she came across a series of Twitter photos of a young girl dressed up as inspiring African-American women from history.
They captured such a sense of history right there, and usually pictures are worth 1,000 words, but I wanted to put 1,000 words with them because I wanted kids and their parents and their grandparents and their teachers and their ministers and everybody to know and remember that these folks lived and achieved so much.
She's going to tell us about the new book she co-produced inspired by these photos. That's coming up later in the show. But first, Governor Gretchen Whitmer says she wants schools offering in-person instruction options again by March. For some districts, this will be the first time having kids back in the classroom since the pandemic began. That was the case for Grand Rapids Public Schools, who welcomed students back into buildings in January after months of online-only learning. Today, the district is actually having a snow day, but they're well into a hybrid learning mode. Here to talk to us about how it's going and what the plan looks like going forward is Superintendent Ledrian Roby. Dr. Roby, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much, April. It's good to be back.
So January 19th was the first day back. What was that first day like?
It was similar to a lot of the first days of school when you think in the fall, where kids are, you know, kind of looking around, they're trying to get to know one another. And what was weird is because, of course, it's January versus August, but lots of excitement, lots of smiles, lots of parents who were extremely happy as they were saying goodbye to their kiddos. Our staff has been phenomenal. They were welcoming kids back, showing them where to go to their classes. Teachers are busy kind of setting the school community in the in-person model. So, you know, helping set expectations with their students, getting an opportunity to get to know them. We all had kind of butterflies like, what is this going to be like? And it went well. I mean, lots of smiles. To be able to hear the laughter on the playgrounds and kids talking to one another, you don't know you miss it until you haven't had it.
How did you decide that mid to late January was the right time to reopen?
So we had a couple of starts and stops. And when we rolled out that we were going to be virtual in August, we were thinking, you know, by maybe mid-October, we'd be ready to go into some in-person learning. And that's when we started to see kind of a huge uptick of number of cases identified with COVID-19. And we, you know, definitely kept our community involved in conversations through surveys and town hall meetings and different ways to kind of see where people were at, working very closely with our stakeholders of our board and our teachers union and our building principals to find out what this looks like. And what we, you know, have always tried to do is follow what the science was saying and seeing where we were as a community, as part of Kent County, and then also statewide, and then watching what other neighboring districts were doing to find out, you know, how they were kind of managing some of these things. And so when we decided that we weren't quite ready in the fall, we pushed it back a little further, and we continued to work with making sure our buildings were ready, making sure that staff had the necessary PPE equipment and the trainings that were in place, and then also keeping our families engaged around what our process was along the way, including a data dashboard so families could see what was taking place in the county, what's taking place in each of our schools. So we're not making things up, that they have a reference point to say, okay, this is what's going on. And then creating a parent handbook that is specifically COVID related. So if there are incidences or things that are taking place, there's a framework for families to follow to say, okay, this is what's going to happen. And this is the processes and protocols that we follow.
I've heard mixed reports from several different school districts and several different grade levels about how those schools across Michigan that are back face-to-face, how it's going, whether kids and staff in different towns have found it difficult to maintain distance and do the other things they need to do to operate safely. How would you say that's going? What does school look like now, and what kind of safety measures have been easy and which have been a little more challenging?
So I think it's going, again, pretty well. If you were to look at our schools now in comparison to where they were, you know, 9 months ago or 10 months ago, you see a lot more signage. And so we have like littered our schools with signage around where to sit and their schedules, and our building principals and their teams have worked very closely. So as we are in hybrid, kids know where they're supposed to go. They know how they're supposed to flow through the building, which is extremely helpful. And I think that has helped. We also have kind of, and when I say details, we have details and plans on top of plans. We have, you know, masks for our kids who may have forgotten masks, or their mask break during the day, or whatever those things are. We have water bottles. We have everything kind of marked off. And again, we are working very closely with our community to keep them informed as to what's taking place, and that has helped. I won't pretend as if no one will ever get sick, but we put forth so many kind of plans to help mitigate that our families and our staff feel really comfortable being in our buildings.
We know that nationally, Black families have been under very specific pressures during the school closures that have happened because of the pandemic. Some of those are health related. You know, sometimes because, you know, parents may be employed at jobs, frontline jobs, where they cannot take sick time. You know, they've made all these arrangements. They've turned everything inside out in order to get this to work. There may also be some families that have concerns about returning their kids to school because they are worried about the learning environment that their kids would be going back into, and they're not sure if the support would be there. Have you noticed any differences between what Black families have been communicating to the district about their comfort level with coming back?
Yes, and I think, you know, thank you for that question. I think with our African-American families and our families of for people of color, often they are more intergenerational within the same household. And so that also is a factor in the decisions that families will have made. And again, we want to make sure that people understand that we are trying our level best to ensure that we have mitigation efforts in place to support their needs. And then also respectful of, yeah, if this doesn't work for your family, here is the other option. And we're going to make sure that your child has the most rigorous experience, academic experience, whether it be in person or virtual. And that's the job and the work that we should be doing. But to the point of, you know, should Black families or our Latino families look at it differently? I think everybody has to decide what works best for their own individual family and situation and make that choice. And then also get information. One of the things that I think I've encouraged people as much as possible, get information. I will certainly do my part to get information out to my broader community. But then I also encourage them to look online at the CDC, look online at the health department, talk to your healthcare workers to find out what you should be doing. Don't just take someone else's word for it. And certainly don't go to like those social platforms where you're looking to see what people are saying. Get information from legitimate, verified sources, and then make a decision what's good for you.
Mm-hmm. Overall, how many of Grand Rapids families did choose to send their kids back in person versus online?
2/3. And so we had about 68% of our families who selected the hybrid option, and about 1/3, which is about 5,000 of our families, students who have remained 100% virtual. And so of the 68% or so, that are in the hybrid, they go to school 2 days a week. They're either in cohort A, which is Monday, Tuesday, or they're in cohort B, which is Thursday, Friday. And Wednesday is our deep clean day. And of course, we are cleaning, you know, every day that students are in session, but we have, you know, 2 days for each of those cohorts.
Do you know how many staffers have been able to get vaccinated in advance of the return to classroom?
So interestingly, we have about 400 of our staff. We just did a survey, and we're starting a survey actually, that about 400 of our staff have been vaccinated either once or have received a booster shot. And because that was something that I wanted to know too. It's like, how has this been made available to our staff? And are they taking advantage of it?
We knew going into last school year, that is in the fall, we knew that there was a percentage of teachers in Michigan that were thinking a little bit more seriously about not returning to the classroom, either retiring or finding some different career options, because there was so much unknown. You know, there was a lot that we didn't know about a vaccine being available. There was a lot we didn't know about how online teaching was going to work. Has it been difficult to staff Grand Rapids classrooms since the return to class on the 19th?
It really hasn't. And I think, I mean, there have been challenges, so I don't want to mislead and make it seem as if, oh yeah, everything's great. We've worked very closely with our teachers union, and again, it's about the collaboration and solution finding together around what's working and what the needs are, and then being responsive to what people are saying that they are needing. But part of it is information. I think our staff have been phenomenal because we have done this work together. It's been a lift together, and we've tried really hard to be really responsive to what people are saying that they need, or taking in suggestions about what this could look like. And so it's not just been, you know, me as a superintendent making the decision or our district office. We've done this work in collaboration with our stakeholders and really have been wanting to have a level of transparency so people are able to get their questions asked and answered. And if we don't know, then that's an opportunity for us to kind of dig deeper.
Dr. Ledrian Roby is superintendent of Grand Rapids Public Schools. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Oh, the captain's in the pilot house, ringing the bell, tell me who's on the way, boys, who's on the way.
Coming up, we explore the hidden history of black sailors on the Great Lakes, complete with a few sea shanties.
Black sailors made about 10% of the crews on Great Lakes ships, and they are very underrepresented in the scholarship.
That story in just a minute. Stick with us.
Oh, the mate, he says one trip up the lake. Tell me, who's on the way, boys? Who's on the way? Just set you up like a Pluto crate. To tell me where you go.
This is Stateside. I'm April Bear. What brightens up those bleak winter days on the shores of the Great Lakes? To paraphrase the great Irish punk Shane McGowan, it's rum, oddities, and the lash. An unexpected flurry of sea shanties have been making the round on social media, most prominently on TikTok. Between our own vibrant traditional folk scene here in the state and our maritime history, Michigan has quite a few shanties of its own to sing. We've been especially interested in the emerging information about sea shanties that were sung by black sailors on the lakes. With us today from the Michigan History Center is curator of exhibits Jillian Reese, who's been looking into this for us. Hi, Jillian.
Hello. How are you, April?
Pretty good. When did black sailors first begin working on the Great Lakes?
So black sailors have been working on the Great Lakes as long as European sailors have. The first ships coming in from France and Britain, long before America was founded, working the fur trade on the Great Lakes, both free and enslaved people working on the ships.
Well, in some places, maritime jobs can be a seasonal line of work. Would that have been true for sailors on the lakes? Would they have had other jobs and other lives?
Yes, definitely. You know, the first fur traders working on the Great Lakes would have come here during the thaw, during the spring and summer. But some folks did stay in Michigan. So Michigan's first Black resident, was born in Mackinac Island to two enslaved people who were there on a French merchant ship over the winter time, and was then baptized at St. Anne's on Mackinac Island.
Wow. Well, what kind of ships would these sailors have been working on? What was driving the industry at that point?
At first, like I said, it would have been the fur trade. As the fur trade waned in the early 1800s, the rise of fishing, and then eventually the big boom of iron ore and copper ore mining in the UP would have brought a lot more activity to the Great Lakes, with shipping goods between places like Milwaukee, Sault Ste. Marie, and Detroit.
Were Black sailors paid on par with their colleagues?
No, they weren't, actually. They were probably paid about half of what white sailors would have been paid, although they did agitate for higher wages and often got them because, you know, it's a solitary life on a ship, and a ship is only as happy as the morale of their crew. So oftentimes we hear oral history stories of Black sailors asking for more and getting it. And they also did different work than white sailors. And you see that in the sea shanties.
I want to talk a little bit more about that. But before we do, the description of the pay rate and the kind of jobs, I guess that kind of tells us a bit about how the captains of these commercial vessels thought about their Black sailors. Do you have any other information to fill in about that?
Yeah. So, you know, when we think about stereotypes that are rooted in racism, particularly people of African descent, a lot of the stereotypes around their labor are revolving around sort of this idea that they have unending strength and constitution and stamina, that they can, you know, do the hardest jobs. And that's one of the things that drove slavery to begin with. When Europeans started settling North America and the Caribbean and South America, they brought people of African descent over because they thought that they were more suited for the back-breaking work that was required to clear forests and jungles. And so, you know, there are still, you know, hints of that today. And, you know, unfortunately, that was something that typecasted a lot of Black sailors when they were working on the ships.
Do we know, for that matter, how the sailors viewed their work? Was this the kind of thing that people did for many years, or maybe just for a while before finding other jobs?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, obviously there were probably lots of sailors that loved it and worked on ships their whole lives. But, you know, even for white sailors, usually working on a ship was a means to an end. You know, you would work on the ship usually when you were younger. It was a good way to see the world and to move around. Particularly in the United States and the upper Midwest, you could go from, you know, New York to Montreal to Detroit to Milwaukee. And you could find communities and areas that you might want to settle in eventually. And so a lot of the first Black Michiganders actually came to settle in Michigan after working on these ships, whether it was the fur trade or fishing or hauling natural resources that fueled the Industrial Revolution. They would then, you know, retire after making their money on the ship and settle in some of these larger cities that dotted the St. Lawrence waterway.
That's really interesting. You know, we've all heard so many stories of the Great Migration. I hadn't even thought about that kind of migration over the waterways into Michigan.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, when we think about the opening of the Erie Canal, what I think a lot of people, popular imagination is thinking about, you know, the Yankees from upstate New York moving to Michigan and coming on ships through the Erie Canal. But actually, the first great migration of people of African descent coming to Michigan was also through the Erie Canal, and they would have been coming along with the Yankees. Some of the first prominent Black Detroiters, for example, came either as passengers, but oftentimes working on these ships, and then, you know, leaving their job and settling in Detroit.
So there was this degree of heightened mobility that working on ships provided to Black sailors. But is there evidence that the shipping industry provided a way to long-term economic improvement in people's lives?
Definitely. You know, a lot of the sailors, when they would retire or maybe leave the industry, would have been able to set up their own businesses. So, for example, one of Michigan's first prominent Black families, the Bongas, settled in Mackinac Island after manumission from being enslaved on a fur trading ship. And they set up a tavern in Mackinac Island. They actually built Mackinac Island's first hotel, so starting the what we know now as the tourist industry in Mackinac Island. And they became so wealthy that they ended up moving down to Detroit and were very prominent in the African-American community there. And they actually, you know, were able to marry into prominent Odawa families and became much more embedded in Michigan's fur trade that way. And there are lots of stories like this where folks were able to work on the ships and then build their own businesses afterwards. I think, though, we shouldn't overstate that, of course. You know, we Black sailors made about 10% of the crews on Great Lakes ships, and they are very underrepresented in the scholarship. Some books about the fishing industry and the merchant industry on the Great Lakes don't even talk about the experiences of these Black sailors. So we know about the more prominent names and the folks who became successful after leaving the shipping industry and leaving their life as sailors. But we really don't know a lot about the everyday people who worked on these ships.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking today with Michigan History Center's Jillian Reese about the less-known history of Black sailors on the Great Lakes. What was the relationship between Great Lakes shipping and the Underground Railroad? I hear what you're saying, that Black sailors were only this smallish percentage of sailors on the ship, maybe 10%. But did this represent an avenue to freedom if there was a willing ship's captain and folks on board who were willing to help?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to think about that 10%, though, in proportion to the number of Black people living in Michigan. I mean, it was in the 1800s, they made up a very small proportion of the overall population. You know, some estimates in the middle of the 1800s say that there were only a couple thousand Black folks living in Detroit, a city that we think about as, you know, this central place for Michigan's Black community. And so you have to think about these ships, you know, coming into harbor, and, you know, one out of every 10 people on the ship is Black. So I think that is definitely, you know, we hear 10% and that might sound like a small number, but it was overrepresented when you think about the overall population of Black Michiganders. But to your question about the Underground Railroad, you know, many ship captains who were white would have, you know, had these racist stereotypes that pigeonholed the type of labor that Black sailors could do on their ships and limited the amount of money they were willing to pay for them. But at the same time, many of these ship captains were Quakers, and Quakers were very involved in the abolitionist movement in Michigan. And so you had, you know, ships that had Black sailors present, and you had ship captains who were sympathetic to abolition, that part of their work was moving between the fluid border between Michigan and Upper Canada. And Upper Canada, of course, was the place where many freedom seekers were trying to go because they were out of reach of slave catchers. So many of these ship captains would bring on freedom seekers onto their ships and disguise them as Black sailors. And we have traditions of folks that gained freedom, but they also gained new life skills. Many of them would actually be working on the ships, making money while they were waiting for their passage. So it provided an opportunity. And, you know, I think we don't know a lot about this experience. We know that there were abolitionists who ran ships and owned ships. But we do know that many folks went across the Great Lakes to Canada to eventual freedom.
Well, we know that sailors certainly find a way to pass the day. And Black sailors at the height of Great Lakes shipping were no different. Will you tell us a little bit more about the sea shanties that you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, so in the 1930s and 1960s, some historians started collecting the oral traditions of Great Lakes sailors. And there is a great repository of this folk history at the University of Michigan. And one of the things that they collected were these folk songs, these sea shanties. And like you said, this was a way to pass time. You know, you don't have to be a great singer to sing a sea shanty, but it was also a labor song. It was something that was meant to keep time when you were working on a ship. And so different activities would have different sea shanties. So there would be sea shanties when you're working on deck. There would be sea shanties for cleaning. There would just, you know, be different ones. And so these historians started recording them. Some of the sea shanties that they recorded were specific to the labor that Black sailors did on the ships. You know, I talked about how there is very little in the sort of traditional scholarship about sailors' lives on the Great Lakes, about Black sailors. But these sea shanties, because they're so rooted in the day-to-day operations of the ships, actually give us a great view into what their experiences were.
So how were these songs preserved? What did researchers in the 30s and the 60s have to go on?
Historians would go out and talk to these sailors, and they would either get recordings of the sea shanties or they would just write down the lyrics. Many sea shanties kind of follow the same tempo and beat. That's basically, you know, how we know about these songs, is that they were passed down through generations of sailors.
I know you're not a musicologist, Jillian, but could you give us an example of the kind of variation in lyrics that you find in the shanties that were sung by Black sailors?
Yeah, one of the more prominent, or I should say well-known, shanties that were sung by Black sailors was one called The Ward Line. And it was a shanty that was sung by sailors working on ships owned by Eber Ward, who was a owner of merchant ships, and he himself was involved in the Underground Railroad and in abolition. So we know that his ships were part of this, and Eber actually, a bounty was put on his head because he was so involved in moving freedom seekers from the United States to Canada. So this song is about the hauling that black sailors would do. And so I said before that black sailors and white sailors would have different jobs on ships. And so white sailors were usually involved in the actual ship sailing, and black sailors were the folks who were hauling the cargo on and off the ship when they got to port. So the sea shanty, which is quite long, it's a number of lines, actually goes through that whole process. One of the first lines in the song is, "Oh, the mate, he says no work on the ship, just lay around and enjoy the trip." And that was the time that they would be sailing. Since black sailors weren't involved a lot of time in the actual sailing of the ship, they would be able to rest during that time.
"Oh, the mate, he says no work on the ship, but tell me who's on the way, boys, who's on the way? Just lay around and enjoy the trip, but tell me where you go. Oh, the mate, he says one trip up the lake, but tell me who's on the way, boys, who's
Jillian,
on the way?
If someone's ears are perking up right now, where can we learn more about the Great Lakes black sailors and their sea shanties?
So we are doing research on it right now at the Michigan History Center, but you can also find songs like The Ward Line on YouTube. Folks have recorded them, and they are available there.
Jillian Reese is curator of exhibits at the Michigan History Center. Jillian, thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks.
"What she'll do, tell me where you go. Lake Superior is colder than ice. Tell me who's on the way, boys, who's on the way? Fall in just once and freeze all your lice. Tell me where you go. Lake Superior is big and rough. Tell me who's on the way, boys, who's on the way?"
Coming up, we tackle the question of whether carbon emissions and climate change should be considered when it comes to approving a tunnel underneath the Straits of Mackinac to house Enbridge's Line 5 pipeline. We'll be right back.
"And the John M. Nickel is a harder ground to tell me where you go. The William H. Stevens is a lying round the bend to tell me who's on the way, boys, who's on the way? And all she's doing is a killing good men to tell me where you go. Now I'm a going back to Detroit to tell me who's on the way, boys, who's on the way? And no more working both day and night to tell me where you go."
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The plan to dig a 4-mile-long tunnel underneath the Straits of Mackinac continues to move forward. That is to replace the existing Line 5 oil and gas pipelines. Last week, the project got approval from one state agency, but others still need to weigh the pros and cons. And one big sticking point in all of this is climate change. That is to say, should carbon emissions from burning oil and gas flowing through Line 5 be a factor in deciding if the tunnel gets a green light? That question is before a Michigan judge right now and could ultimately determine the tunnel's fate. Interlochen Public Radio's Lexi Krupp has the story.
Whenever an energy project is proposed on public lands, like drilling for oil and gas or installing a solar farm, the government has to review the resulting environmental impacts, including greenhouse gas emissions. That's true for pipelines, too.
There's a clear causal link between a pipeline being built or not built and both the production and consumption of that oil, and therefore carbon dioxide emissions, and therefore climate change.
That's Pete Erickson. He studies climate policy at the Stockholm Environment Institute. And he says a project's impact on climate, that can be the deciding factor in whether or not it goes forward. A high-profile case of this is the Keystone XL pipeline, which would have carried oil and gas from Alberta to Nebraska. The main reason the federal government didn't grant a permit for the pipeline was climate change.
The Keystone pipeline is one clear example, but there are others.
In Washington and Alaska, state agencies have rejected different fossil fuel projects because of their carbon emissions.
There's getting to be more cases of governments making these decisions and being upheld in the courts for doing so.
Now, for the Line 5 tunnel project, the company behind the proposal, Enbridge, requested that government agencies make an exception here. They said this is not a new pipeline. This big tunnel project would just replace the old one and make it safer. Enbridge argued their case before an administrative law judge. He's called the ALJ.
He's kind of the gatekeeper.
That's Margreta Kearney, an attorney at the Environmental Law and Policy Center in Chicago.
Here, Enbridge asked the ALJ to exclude any evidence that relates to greenhouse gas emissions or to climate change.
And the judge agreed with Enbridge. Back in October, he said public agencies should not think about greenhouse gas emissions at all with this tunnel project. Then there was this seismic shift in the equation.
Tonight, Governor Whitmer is moving to shut down the controversial Line 5 pipeline in the Straits of Mackinac.
In November, the governor ordered Enbridge to stop the flow of oil and gas through the straits by May. And whether the order will stand, that's playing out in court right now. But it's already impacted the tunnel project. Because before, Enbridge was basically saying, we're going to run this pipeline one way or another.
That narrative goes away if they are no longer able to run the pipeline along the bottom of the Straits of Mackinac. Because then the choice isn't, are we going to run it on the bottom of the straits or are we going to run it at a tunnel? The choice is, are we going to not run the pipeline or are you going to let us build a tunnel so that we can run the pipeline?
And that judge in charge, the ALJ, he's hearing arguments about this question today. In a statement shared with IPR, an Enbridge representative said considering climate is still, quote, extraneous and, quote, outside the scope of the proceeding. Ultimately, it's up to a state agency called the Michigan Public Service Commission and the Army Corps of Engineers to decide whether Enbridge should be able to build their Line 5 tunnel. And maybe when they make their decision, they'll be weighing the impacts of carbon emissions from the project, too. For Stateside, I'm Lexi Krupp.
That story was part of Points North, which is a podcast produced by Interlochen Public Radio. A few years ago, during Black History Month, Rochelle Riley came across a Twitter post that captured both her heart and her imagination. It was a series of black and white photos of a four-year-old girl dressed up as different African-American women who'd made history. Beyond that vast ocean of cuteness, and we're just going to warn you up front, that is considerable. Rochelle felt that there was something special about this little girl honoring struggle and achievement. That was the seed that has now flowered as a book titled That They Lived, African Americans Who Changed the World. And we're talking with the book's co-creator, Rochelle Riley. Hey, Rochelle, welcome back to Stateside.
Hello, thank you so much.
So this book is a collaboration with the photographer who made those pictures, Christy Smith Jones. And I guess we could say it's also a collaboration with Christy's daughter, Lola. Can you describe what Christy's original series looked like?
Absolutely. Back in February of 2017, I'm on Twitter all the time. As people know, I'm pretty fierce on Twitter. And I ran across these photos that were mesmerizing. And I thought, this is so awesome. And I looked at them every day, but I was in the middle of getting ready for the book tour of my first book, The Burden. So I just didn't do anything except love them and keep moving. Well, fast forward a year, in February of 2018, The Burden came out, more book tour. But I saw these photographs and they stopped me in my tracks. And I said, you know what? I can't keep looking at these and not talk to this woman and want to know more. So I went on Facebook and found her and wound up calling her and chatting with her. She's a very shy, stay-at-home mom who literally is an amateur photographer who taught herself to do this just by teaching her daughter Black history.
Wow. Do you remember the first few photos in the series that you saw?
I can remember the one that's my favorite and remains my favorite, and that was Lola at 5 years old, capturing literally the essence and pain and struggle and resilience of Fannie Lou Hamer. It's the famous photo of her with a black eye where she was beaten nearly to death in a jail for trying to get, trying to register voters, black voters. And there were, of course, racists in Mississippi who did not want that to happen. And I saw that photo and saw how Lola was able to capture exactly all of those emotions. And I thought, oh my God, this is very special. Rosa Parks is another one. She is dressed as Rosa Parks with her arrest picture, holding her jail sign. And then there's, I mean, there's so many. Those are some of my favorites. Of course, another favorite is Shirley Chisholm, because she's one of my favorite icons, politician Shirley Chisholm, the first African-American woman to mount a serious bid for the presidency of the United States. She would be so amazed right now to see where we are and what has happened since her death. But some of those were just, they captured such a sense of history right there. And usually pictures are worth 1,000 words, but I wanted to put 1,000 words with them because I wanted kids and their parents and their grandparents and their teachers and their ministers and everybody to know and remember that these folks lived and achieved so much.
You reached out to Christy and asked if you could work together, you writing stories appropriate for all ages to accompany each of Christy's photos. And in each case, there's a photo of the original subject as well as Lola embodying each of these people. Were you using all the subjects Christy had done, or it looks like you've added to it for the book?
Well, I'll tell you, the funniest part of this story was she didn't want to do this. When I called her and she said, "Oh my God, you're Rochelle Riley." And I went, "Okay, you're outside of Seattle in a little town called Kent. You are not intimidated by me." And she said, "Oh, yes, I am. I don't think we can do this. I really don't think so." So I got on a plane and I flew to Seattle and I got in a car and I drove to Kent and I took her family to lunch to talk to them about why this was important. And by the time I was done, she agreed to do it. And I got all excited and I said, "Oh my God, we can get pictures of kids from around the world dressed as their famous icons, and we can do a whole encyclopedia. We can have African-American scientists and African-American business people and African-American musicians." And she said, "No, I'm not doing any of that." And I said, "Oh, okay, let me calm down." She said, "I just want to do this one book." And I said, "Well, if we're only going to do one book, we can't leave out little boys who grow up to be men." So she said, "Well, I will do that. But we have to find a boy." And I said, "I've got a boy." So I flew to Dallas and got my grandson, Caleb, and brought him back. And what she achieved with Lola over the course of a month leading up to Black History Month, she achieved with Caleb between the two of us, and lots of bribes and lots of playing Fortnite in between, doing that with my grandson so that we would have 21 figures, so that they represented men and women. So it's not all of them, because of course she did one every day of Black History Month, so there were 28 women. We have 10 men and 11 women.
Yeah. I'm trying to put my finger on what it is that the photos of Lola and Caleb really bring. I mean, many of these people, like Aretha Franklin and Frederick Douglass, were visually striking in their own right. Do you have words for what it is that the photos of these people as children brings?
Our goal was to remind everyone that every important person, every famous person, every icon was once a child. So no matter where you are, when you're between the ages of 9 and 15 trying to figure out what you want to do, there may come a moment that will change your life. That's why every essay begins with them as children at that moment. And I want people who might not be doing what they want to do to remember that there were moments that changed lives, so it's never too late to change yours. But the main thing is, I literally just want to make sure that these folks are not, these are not hidden figures. These are people that people know, Muhammad Ali and Stevie Wonder and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I wanted people to know that we need to celebrate them as more than posters during Black History Month. They are a part of American history, and everybody should know them. And if they know a little bit more about them, it'll be even harder to forget them. So every single one of them begins with that moment, you know, when Muhammad Ali is the world's most famous person, icon, humanitarian, more than just a boxer. But when he was 12 years old, somebody stole his bike, and he decided he was going to beat him up, and he started learning how to box.
I think the image that gets me closest to it is that photo that you talked about, the one that really took you, you know, really swept you away at first, the photo of Lola as Fannie Lou Hamer. It's so moving. You see Lola, this beautiful, beautiful child, and then the photo of Fannie Lou Hamer herself. Really, everything that she has survived is laid bare in her face. And it's like this incredible bookend of either end of a life of struggle, and just a reminder that, you know, any kid could grow up to be a Fannie Lou Hamer.
That's the point. You have nailed it, literally hit the nail on the head. Every one of these folks were children who could have done anything, gone down any path. Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier for Major League Baseball in the modern era, but when he was 16, he was a member of a gang. You can change your stars in any way that you want, and you don't have to be a child to do it. But I do have to give credit to little Lola, who she at 5 and Caleb at 8. Literally, I've just never seen anything like it where we said, this is who this person was, and we want you to be them for a moment. And the other photo that really gave me pause was when he was being Duke Ellington, and he sat down in his suit at the piano and looked the way Duke Ellington did and smiled. And literally, Christy and I just sort of grabbed each other like, oh my God, are you seeing this? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, are you shooting this? And she said, oh yeah. Just the amazing joy at being, you know, one of the founders, the founder in some people's books of modern jazz, and who wrote more classical jazz compositions that are just a part of our American music book. And, you know, quite frankly, when he was 15, he was, you know, running the counter at a soda fountain and writing Soda Fountain Rag, his first composition, and he didn't know how to read or write music. Just amazing stories and amazing looks.
You've written so many profiles, and I know this. A lot of the subject matter here was not exactly new to you, but when you started, were there trailblazers in the group that you learned something new about or that surprised you?
Almost every one of them. You know, we journalists think we know everything. That, you know, we're supposed to know everything. We're supposed to be. But what we typically do is find everything. And so I treated this like a reporting assignment. So some of the things I knew, I covered Muhammad Ali when I worked in Louisville, so I knew him. I knew his story intimately. I visited his training camp in Berrien Springs, Michigan, before I'd come to Detroit to work. But I think some of the things that were amazing were like, you know, Katherine Johnson, who helped send men to the moon, went to college at 10, and quite frankly, was a math whiz that everybody knew she was a math whiz, but she had to, her family had to move for her to go to a school that would accommodate her prowess and her brilliance. And, you know, you've got kids like that now, and what if their parents don't do that because they don't even think about that possibility? If you have a genius in your family and you don't know, okay, can I make a path or can I help make a path for them that would lead to something amazing, or do I just sort of accept whatever comes along? In almost every one of these cases, there were moments where somebody decided to not accept what came along. Barbara Jordan, one of the greatest orators ever, she'd already decided what she was going to be until she heard this amazing orator and attorney speak at an event and changed her whole mind.
Were there any profiles that were challenging to write?
You know, the strange thing was it's always challenging to write the ones that everybody knows almost all the story. You know, Muhammad Ali, everybody knows the story. Everybody can recite the story. Trying to make sure you're getting in little pieces of information that people might not know so that it's special and new for this book. I wanted this book to be very original and teach people some things that they didn't know so they pay attention. There's lots that you don't know about people that you've studied in history or people you think you know. Get to know them better. If we did that, if we, you know, sort of really taught all children African-American history as a part of American history, we'd have fewer problems with racial conflict than we do now. We've been miseducating children for a long time. If we stop doing that, we can go a long way towards that better America we reach for all the time.
Yeah. You get into the contemporary era, too, with a photo and profile of Caleb as Barack Obama. I feel like this is such a wonderful piece, since Caleb probably actually knew who Barack Obama was, you know, through immediate experience.
Well, he knew
experience.
A lot of these folks, but he did learn some. And I love the idea of making sure young boys know that somebody can start in a gang and get out of a gang and play football and baseball and become someone who changes the world.
Yeah. There's so much that we can say about Barack Obama, especially given the years that immediately followed his presidency. Was it tough to sort of encapsulate all that into one short profile?
Well, now that I think about it, I think he's the answer to your previous question. His was probably the hardest one because his life is so amazing and so filled with so much humanity and diversity. Of his family, he called it, was a mini United Nations. And so much of what he learned from living in different countries, you know, as a child and growing up without his father. It's like there's every facet of different stories that you hear about different people, many of them applied to him. So finding something about him that was special was hard because there were so many moments that were special. But I found one, and I hope people will enjoy reading about it.
Yeah. Given the book that he just published, it feels like he's also still working on, you know, making sense of his story. even as you're doing this too. Rochelle, I noticed that your collaborator, Christy Smith Jones, dedicates all of her work, I guess including this book, to Mary Smith, her grandmother, who she calls the first Black woman to change her world. Is there somebody that you have in mind with your work as well?
Absolutely. I dedicate to my grandparents who raised my brother and sister and me when our parents couldn't. I make people say his name, Mr. Benny Pitt, and you have to say all three, Mr. Benny Pitt, and his wife, Loni Pitt, who took their retirement to make sure that their daughter's children went to college. They mean the world to me, and this is for every family who has someone in it who made sure that they changed the world for some kids.
Gratitude going out to Mr. and Mrs. Benny Pitt, Mary Smith, and all the others who came before. Rochelle Riley, thank you so much for the book. It's called That They Lived, African Americans Who Changed the World, and it's available from your favorite bookseller right now. Rochelle is the Director of Arts and Culture for the City of Detroit and co-creator of this book. Rochelle, we really appreciate you talking to us about it.
Thank you so much, as always.
Arts and Culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Have yourselves a weekend. We'll see you Monday.